Rest in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And good afternoon. Welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon on this December 4th, 2019. This is Bryant Shanley, your host today on Cresta in the Afternoon, as Al is occupied with some things related to the Ave Maria Radio membership drive. We have a great 2 hours coming up for you, some really great interviews I think you're really going to enjoy. We'll be kicking it off with Dr. Greg Popchek on our social science apologetics segment, looking at resolving to build a better church. Pope Francis's challenge is to find more effective ways to bring Christ to the world. How can we do that in a way that focuses on nourishing the seeds of faith rather than lamenting the land that is barren? We'll be talking about that again with Dr. Greg Popchek, who you hear every morning here on Ave Maria Radio on More to Life. And then after that, we'll be getting a testimony story from Troy Guy. He'll be talking about becoming an evangelical Catholic and the biblical and historical evidence that led him to the Catholic Church. He's one of many who, as you listen to Catholic radio, guys like Al, Jimmy Akin, Steve Ray, who were challenged to find what they believed to be the falsehoods of the Catholic Church. And so they began studying history and scripture and the church fathers and found themselves becoming Catholic, something that they never would have imagined. So Troy Guy will be sharing his own story in that very similar vein. And then coming up in the next hour, we will have Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons, who will share his tips on habits for a healthy marriage. Obviously, there are many challenges to marriage in the world today. The breakdown of the family, widespread availability of pornography, the me-first mentality of the culture, and much more. How can we build a strong marriage in such a hostile culture? Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons is going to be looking at that. He, of course, is the author of Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a handbook for couples. He has treated and written about excessive anger and other psychological conflicts in marriage, children, and priesthood for 40 years, and he's the co-author of Forgiveness Therapy. That's Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons coming up in the second hour. First, let's talk to Greg Popchek about resolving to build a better church right after this news break.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, December 4th. It is the Feast of St. John of Damascus. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. Albany Bishop Edward Scharfenberger has been appointed to serve as the Apostolic Administrator to the Diocese of Buffalo following the resignation of Bishop Richard Malone. In an introductory conference today, he said he's not sure how he will divide his time between the diocese, but trusts the Pope's decision, adding, "I'm not here as a knight in shining armor. I'm not here as the fix-it man. I'm just here as a spiritual father." Bishop Malone has faced heavy criticism for his handling of clerical sexual abuse in the diocese, and Pope Francis accepted his resignation this morning after he requested an early retirement during last month's visit to Rome. Quebec's health minister has announced that the province will open a consultation on allowing euthanasia for people who can no longer give informed consent or who will die of an illness in the more distant future. Presently, Quebec permits euthanasia for terminally ill adult residents with an incurable disease who are undergoing great suffering, face imminent death, and give informed consent. The Quebec law was passed in 2014 and took effect in December 2015. President Trump says the growth of nuclear weapons production is the biggest problem the world faces today. He made the comments before meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the NATO summit in London. The president says the U.S. and Russia are in discussions to reduce their nuclear creation. And strong upper-level winds are forcing SpaceX to postpone today's launch of a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral. The rocket is poised to deliver a Dragon cargo ship to the International Space Station with 3 tons of fresh supplies. SpaceX will try again Thursday with liftoff scheduled for 12:29 p.m. Eastern Time. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Gregory Popcheck, who you hear regularly on EWTN Global Catholic Radio, in his program More to Life, which he hosts with his wife, Lisa. And Greg joins me about once a week. We talk about something called social science apologetics, where we take a look at the world of the social sciences, research that's being done, and time and again we're finding that the Catholic way of life is receiving some measure of confirmation from research that's happening. Greg, good to have you back.
Well, great to be here, Al. Thank you.
We've talked about this positive psychology movement before. What do you think its greatest contribution has been to pastoral counseling?
Well, you know, I think it has yet to make more of a contribution to being pastoral in general, not just pastoral counseling. Because here's the thing, you know, we with Pope Francis' ministry especially, we're hearing more about the importance of being pastoral. A lot of people are writing about what does it mean to reach out to this disaffected population or these folks who are struggling to reconcile with the church. And those are all great questions to ask. But I think that in general what's happening is that we're using an old psychological model to ask these pastoral questions, and it's getting in our way.
Okay.
Positive psychology offers us a new way forward, I think, to really reach out to people in a dramatic and effective way, but it's not being tried yet in pastoral circles. So I want to talk a little bit about what that means.
From the standpoint of movements within the academic world, it's been around since 98, I think it begins, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that a long time?
Well, it's not all that long, but the reality is that the idea for it began even in the late 60s, early 70s with Abraham Maslow, who started criticizing clinical psychology. He said that our focus on a disease model led to a sick psychology that could tell people what was wrong with them, but never really point a clear way out.
Yeah.
And so in the late 90s, psychologist Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania developed something he called positive psychology, where what he suggested
as opposed to sick psychology.
Exactly, yeah. As opposed to sick psychology, where, you know, instead of studying, you know, sick people and finding out why are they sick, maybe we should study healthy people and figure out why they're healthy and then teach that to the sick people, you know?
Right.
We laugh about it now, but in reality it was very revolutionary, and a lot of people were concerned. I mean, isn't that minimizing the suffering of depressed people or anxious people? You know, aren't you just saying, you know, why can't you be like them, you know? And that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But what we've found now with two decades or three decades of research out almost is that the positive psychology movement has been the most effective way to help people who are struggling with very serious emotional problems develop the healthy skills they need to adapt. And you start by asking people who, for example, have struggled with a marital issue or struggled with emotional problems and were successful, and you learn from them. You say, well, what did you do to make that work for you? How did you get through that well? You identify those skills and then teach them to other people. Well, you might say, so what? Well, this has a big thing to play in the whole movement to be more pastoral, because currently what we're doing is, I think, we have a sick approach to pastoral ministry, and we need to have a more positive approach rooted in what we're describing just now.
Well, it strikes me that when you hear all this discussion about we need to become more welcoming, we need to be spending more time accompanying people, all well and good. But unfortunately, it's received in a way as though it's a judgment on the way things are. And so I think people are resisting the idea.
Yeah.
Pope Francis has tried to make clear that we don't want to be a self-referential church. We want to be reaching out to others. So all of this plays into how do we present the gospel? How do we present the healing resources that Christ has placed within the church? Is there something that's even gone wrong with the way that Pope Francis' emphasis has been received? I mean, there's been all this controversy over somebody like Father James Martin's approach.
Right.
Well, yeah, and here's the problem. The problem isn't that the people are asking questions. The problem isn't that people are trying to figure out how can we be more pastoral to disaffected groups. The problem is the way we're going about it, right? So, you know, instead we ask questions like, you know, why don't young adults stay faithful? Or right. why don't couples use natural family planning?
Right.
Or why don't LGBT people or divorced people or people in irregular situations feel welcome in the church?
Right.
And the problem, those sound like good questions, but what they do is they lead to a sick approach
yeah.
to pastoral ministry
yeah,
that grinds down on the problem,
right.
but that doesn't lead to any kind of clear solutions, right? And so then what we do is we just end up very polarized. Oh, well, what we need are more contemporary liturgies, or what we need is more traditional liturgies, or,
right.
hey, let's scrap NFP training. No,
right.
we need to require NFP training. And it just breaks down around
yes.
doctrine or political lines as opposed to really identifying real solutions.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a more positive psychology approach to pastoral ministry, what you're going to do is you go to people who have the problem, and who are living faithfully and successfully in spite of that problem. So,
right.
for instance, you talk to couples who are doing NFP, and you say, you know, I know you guys struggled with it from time to time. How'd you get through that? And how has this
yeah.
been a blessing in your life? And then you teach that to other couples who are struggling with NFP. Or you go to people who are struggling with same-sex attractions, but who have found joy and meaning and satisfaction in the teachings of the church, and you say, how'd you come to that place? And then you teach that to other people who are struggling with it. Right now, our approach is to treat those successful people as outliers.
Right.
Oh, they don't have anything to teach anybody else. They figured it out. That's good for them. But look at all these other people who are affected over here. Clearly, that can't have anything to do with them. So we end up discounting the successful cases to focus obsessively on what's wrong and argue back and forth about how we can make it even wronger.
Yeah. It's an excellent point, because we've seen through courage and encourage, we've seen very successful models and examples and testimonies of those who have struggled with same-sex attraction and with parents who have had to work on their relationship with their same-sex attracted children. And we've seen really movements of grace in people's lives. However, rarely are these people called upon to share with us how they, in fact, found grace in their struggle against same-sex attraction, and how they found the teaching of the church to be help them in their own flourishing.
Well, exactly, and that's my biggest criticism of Father Martin's book. I know that he's
right.
taken a lot of heat. My biggest criticism is that what I call sampling error. You know, he wants to create a dialogue with people who are struggling with same-sex attraction with the LGBT community, and that's a good thing. We need to do that.
Sure.
But why not invite the people who have actually successfully struggled with it or are successfully struggling with that issue and learn from them?
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Why are they not included in the dialogue? And that's just true of our entire approach to pastoral ministry. You know, the whole NFP debate, you know, instead of arguing, well, do we teach it or don't we teach it, talk to couples who are struggling or have struggled and successfully resolved it and found ways to celebrate the joys that natural family planning can bring to their relationship, and then teach those things to other couples, you know,
yeah.
instead of treating them like weirdos for actually living the teachings of the church. You know, we have this weird idea that somehow people who are actually living the gospel have nothing to say to people who are struggling with it, and the opposite is really true. We've got 20 years of psychological research saying that's a crazy way to approach anything.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. It is funny. People who are finding joy, human flourishing, creativity, abundant life, and fulfilling relationships within Catholicism, oh my gosh, what do we have to learn from them? They must be special.
Yeah, exactly. There's just a special class of people who don't ever have any problems. How insulting is that?
It's terrible.
Beyond just being insulting, it's just bad. It's bad science.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's what the positive psychology movement really has to teach us. It's not that there's that much difference between people who are successful and people who struggle. They're the same people. It's just that people who are successful with this have certain skills.
Yeah.
And if we can learn what those skills are and offer them to the people who are struggling, more often than not, we will be more effective at helping those struggling people.
Is there a conversation going on between Catholic psychologists and the U.S. bishops?
There is. I think the part of the but the idea of a Catholic psychology is a relatively new one.
Okay.
You know, so for example, the Catholic Psychotherapy Association was just founded within the last 10 years. And even in that organization, I'm the chair of the education committee for them. You know, and even in that organization, there's sort of professionals trying to figure out what does it mean to practice psychology as a faithful Catholic professional.
Yeah.
You know, so the idea of melding Catholic anthropology with psychological practice is sort of a new one. And
right.
so, yeah, there obviously are dialogues that the bishops are having with various psychologists. But part of the problem is that psychologists haven't gotten our act together enough to be able to effectively advise our bishops on what it really means. So, you know, I'm glad to kind of be putting out these questions and doing a lot of work, for example, through Holy Apostles and the Master of Arts and Pastoral Studies program there, teaching pastoral counseling, our work through the Pastoral Solutions Institute. We're probably on the cutting edge of just this idea of integrating
right.
Catholic teaching and Catholic anthropology with clinical practice. But it's a new concept.
Yeah, no. Why is it a new practice? I mean, it isn't as though this hasn't been raised from the beginning. I mean, even the beginnings of academic psychology, there was a Christian anthropology out there. And Christians were involved in the early various psychological movements. It wasn't all
yes.
Freud, for heaven's sake.
Well, in fact, it was a Catholic who brought the first psychology lab to the U.S.,
yes.
a Catholic university. Yeah. So Catholics have been involved in psychology from the very beginning.
So
but
what
but,
happened?
But,
yeah.
Well, there's a really weird history there, and a big part of it was that just the psychologists, secular psychology, really saw itself as the science of the soul,
right?
Because of course psychology means study of the soul,
right?
And a lot of pastors really objected to that. Hey, that's our area,
yeah.
right? And there became this conflict from the very earliest stages, especially since Freud was so hostile to religion,
right?
That the battle lines were drawn, and so psychologists and pastors really reacted off of each other and saw each other as the enemy for a lot of years. In the early 60s, you know, there were a lot of Catholic psychologists who felt discounted in the American Psychological Association, so they started their own organization called the Catholic American Psychological Association as a division
uh-huh.
of the APA,
yeah.
which was mainly, though, not about finding an integration of Catholicism and psychology, but as a way of establishing their legitimacy as professionals, even though we're Catholic. We're
okay.
still good psychologists. And that eventually became Division 36 of the APA, which is the division that studies the psychology of religion. So, you know, it just generalized from there. So now, finally, Catholic psychologists are saying, what does it mean to actually practice as faithful professionals?
Right, right. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. It's going to be a fruitful conversation, I'm sure.
Thank you, Al.
Greg, how do people stay in touch with you?
CatholicCounselors.com.
Again, Dr. Gregory Popchak, author of many books, also heads up the Master of Arts in Pastoral Studies program at Holy Apostles College.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
How can parents raise faithful kids in a faithless world? A 50-year study of over 3,500 people found that the degree of parental warmth kids experience in religious households was the single biggest factor in determining whether children would become faithful adults. As I summarize in my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids, children are most likely to become faithful adults when they've experienced the faith as the source of the warmth in their homes. The same study found that rates of faith retention in kids skyrocketed when religious dads took point on practices that contributed to a warm, faithful household. Things like generous affection, maintaining strong family rituals, and gentle approaches to discipline. God created parents to give kids a physical sign of His love. The more warmth our kids experience in our presence, the more warmly they'll feel toward the God who loves them through us. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Nothing illustrates the powerful bond between man and wife intended by God, the creator of marriage, than these words from Matthew's Gospel. A true marriage is a sacramental bond and is therefore indissoluble. The Catholic Catechism, however, realistically acknowledges that the presence of evil can severely strain this bond. Marital union has always been threatened by discord, a spirit of domination, jealousy, infidelity, and conflicts that can escalate into hatred and separation. The original communion of Adam and Eve was ruptured by their sin of disobedience. Their relations were distorted by mutual recrimination, says the Catechism, and brought about the pain of childbirth and the toil of work. Without God's help, a man and woman cannot achieve the union of their lives for which God created them in the beginning. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
We have a problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com, a nonprofit company.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, and with me right now is Troy Guy. He's the author of Evangelical Catholic, A Journey Through the Biblical and Historical Evidence. Now, the former evangelical Protestant, he has now been reconciled with the Apostolic Church. He's also an FAA-certified commercial pilot and flight instructor, and maintains a website, discoverhischurch.com. Troy, good to have you here.
Hi, Al. It's good to be with you today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your own story before we get to the evidence itself, since it's all intertwined. How were you raised?
I was raised a Baptist, a nominal Baptist, and went to church pretty regularly.
Okay. Was the faith important to you growing up?
Faith was important, but it wasn't the main thing in life. Mm-hmm. But my parents did give me that remarkable opportunity to visit church, weekly or so.
Mm-hmm. And when did you come to a place in your life where you realized that God was calling you to something beyond what you were familiar with?
Well, I became a Christian in 1989, and at the Southern Baptist Church, we were studying the Nicene Creed, and it was at that time that I realized that there was something a little bit larger than my own Protestant church, and so I just kind of followed that path of the one holy Catholic and apostolic marks that those, those early Christians had defined, and kind of took me to a different place.
Mm-hmm. How over what period of time did this kind of, did you marinate in this idea?
Oh, I marinated almost 15 years.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I know. Some of us take a while. And so during that 15-year period, were you, what were you reading? What was helping you along the way?
Baptist tradition, it was pretty much Bible alone.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, sure.
Sola Scriptura. But I read other things, Josh McDowell and some other Protestant authors, some of the typical people you've heard about. But it was mainly Scripture alone.
And so you were there particular texts that were that just didn't fit your Southern Baptist theology?
Yes. Well, one of those being, of course, Matthew 16:18, you know, establishing the church, and several church, verses that I had never seen before. I think the Catholics just kind of snuck them in there. And I saw a lot of those.
Yeah, did you have any help from fellow Catholics, eventually fellow Catholics, or was this pretty much something you worked through on your own?
Well, it was in ministry, I tried to kind of look at Catholics as the object of my evangelism, and every opportunity I'd get, I would, of course, try to share the gospel with a good Catholic, you know, and seeing them as lost. And one of the gentlemen that I met and ended up becoming good friends with him, he asked me one day, he said, you know, your Baptist church was you know, set up after 1517 or so, maybe in the 1700s, but what came before that, Troy? You know, he really made me think, you know, and so I began this thought process, what did come before the Protestant Reformation? You know, I was always taught that the Baptist church was here since Christ, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So did you go back and try to find landmarks through medieval history and late antiquity to try to draw continuity between your Baptist church and the New Testament church?
Absolutely, and that's what got me in trouble, Al. I went back to folks like Clement of Rome, you know, and Ignatius of Antioch, and Cyril of Jerusalem, and Ambrose, and Augustine, and John of Damascus, and one of the things that I, you know, you couldn't, you know, I went there for validating Protestantism and walked away Catholic. You really, really can't read the early church fathers without noticing just how far away from Protestantism the early church really was. I mean, they, you know, they're talking about bishops and apostolic succession and Peter's primacy and honoring Mother, you know, of the Lord, and they believed in the real presence of Christ and this thing called the Eucharist. And so, in other words, when I went there trying to validate my beliefs, I walked away knowing that the early church of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries was thoroughly Catholic.
Yeah. I found it, I had a similar experience. Friends of mine, actually relatives, had asked me to do some study of a particular cult group that had published a book that dealt with the Council of Nicaea. And so I went back and read the Nicene Fathers and then went back before that to the Apostolic Fathers. And I'm reading, you know, Ignatius of Antioch and Clement of Rome. I'm saying to myself, these don't sound, I mean, if these guys were in a kind of an evangelical church pulpit, they'd be under great suspicion today. Because they were talking about things that simply were not accepted within the evangelical community of which I was a part. And I took me years to figure out what to do with that, because I assumed there had been continuity between the apostles and then those who followed them and right on through the Middle Ages. And I figured the Reformation was a time when the church was, quote, purified again and went back to its original intention. But it looks as though the problems that Catholics had were there right from the beginning with the with the generation immediately succeeding the apostles.
And right.
It's a very awkward place to be. When you began to see this contradiction between the Protestantism that you were practicing and the thought of the generation immediately succeeding the apostles and having been in contact with the apostles, what did you do? I mean, I'm just curious. Did you sit? Did you scream? Did you run around to libraries? Did you get a hold of a priest? How did you respond to that contradiction? Or maybe you're a calmer person than I am. No.
I think I probably had a similar experience. I wanted to scream, but inwardly I was pretty much in denial.
Yeah.
Like you pointed out, this you know, these unbroken apostolic succession, you know, going back to Peter, and you know, and really the Catholic Church's structure, the apostolic origin, teaching, had been there for 2,000 years, and as a Baptist, I didn't know what to do with that.
Right.
Completely lost. So the first thing I did was to go into denial. You know, this must be something I'm misreading. So I would go to another church father, and I would go to a priest. And frankly, some of the priests pointed me back to even some of the 12th century and the 800, you know, in the 800 AD. And no matter where I looked, I couldn't get out of the fact that the early church was thoroughly Catholic.
Yeah, it was. It's very upsetting for a while. Now, were you bothered by? I mean, that's what I call a continuity problem. Were you also bothered by the problem of that Protestantism had divided into so many competing denominations that it was hard to see the one church that Jesus had prayed for in John chapter 17? Did that become a problem for you too?
That was a huge problem. Now, one of the, you know, when Jesus established, and you know, I say in Matthew 16, 18, you know, looking over those marks, I began to ask, you know, could I honestly claim that Protestantism in any shape was one church? And like you pointed out, Jesus just established that one church in Matthew, and he prayed for Christian unity, of course, in John 17.
Yeah.
But in Protestantism, how can we get to the point that we have truly over 30,000 different denominations? And, of course, those numbers come from Protestant seminaries.
Sure.
You know, there's not anything that Catholics, you know, make up.
Right.
Truly there are. So which one of those was correctly the, you know, the true church? And I think, Al, that goes into the kind of the second thought that I remember really hitting me hard was, could I honestly claim that my Baptist church or any Protestant church, in that matter, was apostolic? You know, we claim to be apostolic and that, you know, we believe what the apostles taught, right? But it breaks down when you consider that those thousands of different Protestant denominations, each claiming that they're teaching what the apostles taught, but actually differing on what that actually means.
And yeah.
And for Baptists, that really hit home when I considered baptism. I mean, just something, you know, you would think would be continuity. But in our church, you know, it's baptizing adults only, just across the street.
Sure, that's right.
Literally, it was Methodists, you know, baptizing infants. So how do you bridge that dilemma within Protestantism? You don't. You just continue to divide and create more denominations.
Yeah. You know, for a while I tried the idea of, well, this isn't really division. This is diversity. This is difference. We should celebrate the differences. And then it dawned on me that, well, that isn't the way people saw this in the past. They fought over these things. They divided over these things. People were executed sometimes over these things. This wasn't some sort of beautiful flourishing of creative possibilities within Christianity. These were,
exactly.
You know, these people shed blood over these differences. So that was an attempted solution that didn't work out for me. We have
very much common in my life too. Every which way I looked, I just couldn't escape it. Yeah.
Now, I've noticed with converts I've talked to in the past is they get to the place where intellectually they can no longer defend the Protestant tradition that they've been raised in, and they're actually fairly good at defending either the Catholic Church or Orthodoxy, but they don't really feel like they want to cross the Tiber, and you know, they don't want to necessarily identify with, in a personal way, with the Catholic Church or any apostolic church, if you want to throw Orthodoxy in there. Did you linger for a long time before you actually reached a point of intellectual decision, but did not get to the place of making a firm commitment to Catholicism? Did you live in limbo for a while?
I was very much in limbo. Limbo for about 8 years.
Yeah.
Where I knew in my heart, I knew in my mind, but I wasn't ready to make that announcement either to my current church or to my family,
yeah,
for that matter.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, Troy, hold it there. We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue conversation here and find out again how you handled that with your family, and also continue to talk about these truths that led you into full communion.
with the Catholic faith. My guest, Troy Guy, lives in Texas with his wife, Lisa, and their four children. He works in the aerospace industry. He holds degrees in electrical and nuclear engineering, as well as physics. We're talking about his book, Evangelical Catholic, which describes his experience discovering the Catholic faith and looks at the biblical and historical evidence.
Are you looking for an affordable option for your health care? You feel compelled to support pro-life efforts in our country? Then now is the time for you to join CMF Curo. CMF Curo is the country's first healthcare sharing experience that engages church teachings by offering truly pro-life healthcare. CMF Curo members experience healthcare that's ethically consistent with church teachings and rooted in Catholic community. Learn more about CMF Curo and find Catholic healthcare options at mycatholichealthcare.com.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Let us strive to know the Lord. Quick question to you and me right now. Is that what you and I are doing every single day? When you and I wake up every day, do we strive to know Jesus or not? In the Old Testament, in the same book of Hosea, a little bit later on, it's in chapter 14, the Lord says through the prophet, "My people perish." Or in another translation, "My people are being destroyed because of a lack of knowledge." Not a lack of data. We got tons of data. Not a lack of information. We got a lot of information. Not just about things that are happening in the world. We got a lot of data, a lot of knowledge, a lot of information about God. But not a lot of intimacy with God. Not a lot of relationship with God. Not a lot of friendship. That's the cry of God's heart. God wants to give himself to us in the incredible gift of friendship. And we're not taking advantage of it.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We recently filed a civil rights lawsuit in federal court in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Oklahoma against the city of Tulsa and its chief of police for unlawfully firing one of its police officers because local political activists complained to the city about conservative social media posts the officer had made several years prior to his hiring as a Tulsa police officer. In a cowardly act of political correctness, the city of Tulsa and its chief of police fired a good officer because local left-wing political activists complained about certain Facebook posts allegedly made by our client 3 to 6 years prior to his hiring as a police officer. These activists play the race and anti-Islam cards every chance they get because, quite frankly, they hate white conservative Christian police officers. It's a shame that the Tulsa police leadership was so willing to throw the officer under the bus to appease these radicals. While the Tulsa leadership might side with these anti-police activists, I can assure you that the rank and file do not. As set forth in the lawsuit, it is well settled that the government cannot condition public employment on a basis that infringes the employee's constitutionally protected interest in freedom of expression. Our lawsuit alleges that the city's firing of the officer violated his rights protected by the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. We are seeking damages and attorney's fees. I'm Robert Use, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Troy Guy. He's the author of Evangelical Catholic, which we'll have available, of course, at the online bookstore, and you can also get it through him. But we were talking about this period of time, in his case, 8 years, and this is very common, where people who, Protestants of various sorts, who find themselves no longer able to really fly the flag of their individual denomination, find themselves in kind of a no man's land for a while, they're not quite ready to pope or cross the Tiber or identify with the Catholic Church in a concrete way. And so they live with this kind of divided mind regarding these issues. You mentioned that you even kept it from your family, huh?
I did. I my wife and I, we would go and sit in the Baptist church or sometime non-denominational there at the end, and I would always kind of ask her, you know, hey, do you ever consider the idea that maybe the Lord's Supper is not symbolic? And, so I would throw out small things, but in my mind I knew that it was just a matter of time, just a matter of time.
And was she receptive as you went along?
At first she was pretty cautious and questioning. After all those Catholics over there, you know, they were worshiping Mary and all kinds of things. And but it took she was open-minded.
Yeah. Did you have to disclose your decision to a church body, or had you kind of left your local church by that time?
Yeah, well, we kind of snuck out the back, if you will. We maintained friendship with our pastor, and in fact, we still speak to him today quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And we just quietly left and did not have to announce our departure.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And then tell me about your experience about being received into full communion with the church. Any problems you might have had? Any joys that you had? What was the experience like?
Al was wonderful.
Beautiful.
We did enter RCIA. We were given I was given the option of going ahead and being received into full communion, but I chose to wait for our family.
Yeah.
Which I think I mentioned before, we had 7 members of our family enter the church at the same time, and it was fantastic. And the great joy that I remember is knowing that I was now taking the real body of Christ, the real presence of Christ, for the first time in Holy Communion.
Yeah, yeah. So you then, your RCIA worked well for you. When you were fully received, you were aware that this was a turning point. You weren't just changing, quote, denominations. You were changing, you were actually entering into deeper mystical union with Christ.
Absolutely. That was the experience throughout all of RCA, and RCA it proved to be a good thing for our family too.
Good. Tell me why.
Well, our kids were able to watch, their parents, my wife and I, and in fact, my mother-in-law, father-in-law, go through this change. And each and every night after RCA, we would come home and discuss those things that maybe were different from the Baptist Church, and how we were entering more deeper into the mystical body of Christ by each of those things, whether it was our bread of life, the Holy Eucharist, or how we could now start looking at traditions, how we can invite the Mother of our Lord into our lives, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. When did you begin writing on this topic?
I began writing about 2 years ago, and the book itself took me about a year to complete. So I've been writing for quite a while.
Did you keep notes while you were going through the process over those 15 years?
I did. I had lots of books, lots of notes, and going back to conversations, to other converts that have gone before us. Of course, I can think of people like Scott Hahn and of course, Steve Ray, and people like that. In fact, I've reached out to various of people in certain times, and those conversations I've kept and gone over as well.
Yeah, yeah. With your work now, do you spend a good deal of time sharing your faith with non-Catholics?
I think now I share the faith much more than I ever shared before.
Interesting.
I have a zeal that placed in me that I never have experienced as a Protestant, and it's really interesting too, Al, because one of the great joys that has happened recently is we've teamed with the Coming Home Network to some degree, in reaching out to some local Protestant pastors who have invited us to come and share why we are Catholic. You know, what was our turning point? What drew us to the Catholic Church? And to enter into some truly an ecumenical dialogue.
Yeah.
So that's proven very fruitful.
That's great. So these are non-Catholic Christian leaders who are interested in, I assume, some sense of helping restore some plausible unity, and they're willing to at least listen. Is that right?
That's right. They're very much interested in unity. And, you know, there's about three or four that are Baptists, you know, a whole bunch of Methodists.
Yeah.
So what I'm finding is that there's a greater interest in Christian unity than maybe we see on the outside of our church bulletin boards, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Right. Well, I think something has happened, at least within evangelical Protestantism in America over this last generation. I think that they've had so many internal conflicts with the rise of the name it and claim it movement, the prosperity gospel movement, and they've had other groups that have gone off and become non-Trinitarian. And I think many evangelical Protestants who are aware of these things are asking themselves, these were all Bible-alone groups. What the heck happened? They've now walked off into areas that are either directly heretical or they're really pushing the boundaries of biblical Christianity. I think there are some sensitive leaders out there that realize they've got a problem, and they're at least willing to open the conversation and sit down with Catholics and say, well, how do you guys handle this?
Absolutely. And we're seeing that in a lot of cases. For example, some of my Methodist colleagues are very interested in what the next year is going to bring for them in terms of same-sex attraction.
Exactly.
And how that looks into the... Yeah, and so they're already planning yet another division, though, if depending on how the vote is. And I think that goes back to the strength of the Catholic Church once again, that we're the boat in this stormy sea of change. And I think that's a great testimony going all the way back to when Christ established it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And what I love about the Catholic faith, too, is that it certainly preserves the faith delivered once for all, the apostolic faith delivered to the saints in the first century. But it also preserves that dynamic spirit-led tradition, which enables the church to, again, not just wall itself off from the culture, but engage the culture and stay faithful in the midst of it. It doesn't just run away and hide. It actually walks through, you know, the culture of which it's a part. It deals with issues, deals with secular feminism. It deals with the sexual revolution. It engages it as it goes along. And I think that this, again, Catholics should be really proud of the church's leadership in the whole field of bioethics and the way we're dealing with issues like embryonic stem cell research and cloning and alternatives that Catholics frequently find that can help. So I just think we sometimes are so aware of our shortcomings that we fail to realize the extraordinary blessings that the church brings. The world has a great debt to the Catholic Church, and I'm hoping as time goes on we continue to be faithful that that'll be seen. I mean, what's funny about it is all this diversity talk that's going on today where people want to say, you know, being accepting of all these different cultures and languages and skin pigmentations and ethnicities. The Catholic Church was the leader in that. We were the universal community, you know? And we should, again, recognize that Christ has been working through his people for a long time here, and he's got great blessings available for those who would recognize him. Now, with your with the ministry that you have, Are you working closely with the Coming Home Network then?
We are working closely with them. We're working closely with them in different areas. Next month, I'll be on the Journey Home show, and we're working with John Mark and Grodi and various different ministries, again, related to the Protestant pastor outreach. And so we're building a great bridge there. And one of the things we're finding that we both are interested in is how to reach out to our separated brothers and sisters in terms of unity, building authentic unity with them and bring them back to the church.
Yeah, that it takes, and one has to be patient about that, too. I mean, you don't just, you know, we just don't win by whacking people with a few Bible verses. People need to be oriented to the whole rich conversation that the church has on this. Do you think we'll see?
That's one thing we...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, that's one thing that we really saw in our meeting with the Protestant group is that they were all pastors, all severely concerned with the gospel, severely concerned with reaching that unity in Christians. And I think the dialogue, if you really sit down and you don't Bible bash and sling verses, and there's a time for you know, standing up for
faith, course.
But there's also a time for bilateral, you know, discussion.
Yep.
And I think that's very fruitful because Catholics have nothing to hide and everything to preach. And so it's just a matter of doing it, I think.
Yeah. Well, tell people how they can learn more of the work that you're doing there, Troy, and get a hold of the book.
Our website is discoverhischurch.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at Catholic Troy. So the main place is discoverhischurch.com.
Very good. Thanks so much, Troy. We'll talk again.
Thank you, Al.
Troy Guy, the book is called Evangelical Catholic. It examines the biblical and historical evidence that helped Troy come into full communion with the Catholic Church. I'm Al Cresta.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's the definition of frustration? Frustration is the difference between the way it is and the way you want it to be. It's hard to change the way it is. The way it is sometimes is other people, life, circumstances. The way you want it to be is in your power to change. You can close the gap between reality and what you want. The smaller that gap, the less your frustration. It is always easier to change oneself than to change reality. Frustration isn't always what happens out there. It is how we look at what happens out there.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Facts for Christianity. How can we trust the accuracy of the gospel stories when they were not written down for 30 to 60 years after the events occurred? The answer, in short, is oral tradition. But that sounds so unreliable. We all know how distorted things get when people today share stories by word of mouth. Yet, in the first century, things were much different. Because illiteracy was so high, society then implemented safeguards like strict memorization. It's reported that Rabbi Perduda used to repeat every passage 400 times for a dull pupil, and once for an especially dull one, repeated it 400 times more. From time immemorial, teachers in the Near East have practiced this kind of technique, repetition. And that's a fact for Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
And thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. This is Bryant Shanley, your host and Alice executive producer. Troy Guy's book, Evangelical Catholic, A Journey Through the Biblical and Historical Evidence That Led Yet Another Evangelical Protestant to the Apostolic Church, is available, of course, in the online bookstore at AveMariaRadio.net, where you can also check out the Cresta guest archives, different materials that were used for today's program, find past programs, find our featured articles, and much, much more at AveMariaRadio.net. Some of you may be wondering what's going on with the delay in the beatification of Archbishop Fulton Sheen. That, of course, was a big surprise to all of us when we saw that last night. And unfortunately, not a whole lot of information is available yet. We are continuing to follow that, and we will have more on tomorrow's program, which we'll be talking about more at the end of the second hour, as well as the news regarding the resignation of Bishop Malone in Buffalo, New York. Today is also, as you probably know, the feast of St. John of Damascus. This is a few things. Jimmy Akin has a great article, which we'll have available for you at AveMariaRadio.net. 7 things to know and share about St. John Damascus and why he is called the last church father. St. John of Damascus was born around the year AD 675 in what is now Syria. And is if you ask Pope Benedict why he was so significant, Benedict wrote, "Above all, he was an eyewitness of the passage of the Greek and Syrian Christian cultures shared by the eastern part of the Byzantine Empire to the Islamic culture, which spread through its military conquests in the territory commonly known as the Middle or Near East." John of Damascus is also known for his work on how Catholics should treat relics and was very integral in establishing the differences between the veneration of relics and the worship of relics. And so all of that and much more is discussed by Jimmy Akin in his article, The Last Church Father, 7 Things to Know and Share, which we will have posted for you at AveMariaRadio.net. Coming up in the next hour, as I mentioned earlier, we will be talking about Habits for a Healthy Marriage with Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons, who is the author of Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a handbook for Catholic couples. And he'll be looking at how you can build a strong marriage in this culture that is so hostile to the foundation of the family. And we will have all of his information also at AveMariaRadio.net. Coming up next hour, as I said, Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons, right after this break.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Welcome back to the second hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. This is Bryant Shanley, executive producer for the program, and your host today, as Al deals with some other obligations related to Ave Maria Radio. Coming up in this hour, a great interview with Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons on Habits for a Healthy Marriage. As we all know, there are many challenges to marriage in the world today. The breakdown of the family, the widespread availability of pornography, the me-first mentality of the culture, and so much more. But you can build a strong marriage, and Dr. Fitzgibbons advises you can do so by building on positive psychology, focusing in on the growth of virtue in you and your spouse. We're going to talk with Dr. Fitzgibbons in just a few minutes. Those of you wondering what's going on with the delay in the beatification of Archbishop Fulton Sheen, that was the news we just saw yesterday evening as we were wrapping up the program. Apparently there were some bishops in the USCCB who asked that his canonization cause be further considered. And unfortunately, nobody knows who those bishops were. The people who do know aren't saying. A statement from the diocese did tell Catholic News Agency this is not related to allegations that Bishop Sheen covered up acts of sex abuse. And this church official who spoke to CNA said, quote, "The allegation from the U.S. lawsuit has been on the internet for 10 years. Everything said of Sheen's life has been examined during the process for beatification. We will be continuing to follow that story, and we'll have more on tomorrow's program when Bruce and Chris McGregor guest host. They will also be speaking about the resignation of Bishop Malone in the Diocese of Buffalo. All that's coming up tomorrow. Of course, you can find more new information on these articles at AveMariaRadio.net. Also, check out the National Catholic Register, Catholic News Agency, Crux, and other similar sites who are all covering both of these stories. And you can go to AveMariaRadio.net. After the program, you'll have these articles will be posted in the featured article section, as well as in the Crest to Guest archive. All that's coming up over the next couple of days. But first, let's talk habits for a healthy marriage with Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons after this news break.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, December 4th. It is the Feast of St. John of Damascus. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. Albany Bishop Edward Scharfenberger has been appointed to serve as the Apostolic Administrator to the Diocese of Buffalo following the resignation of Bishop Richard Malone. In an introductory conference today, he said he's not sure how he will divide his time between the diocese, but trusts the Pope's decision, adding, "I'm not here as a knight in shining armor. I'm not here as the fix-it man. I'm just here as a spiritual father." Bishop Malone has faced heavy criticism for his handling of clerical sexual abuse in the diocese, and Pope Francis accepted his resignation this morning after he requested an early retirement during last month's visit to Rome. Quebec's health minister has announced that the province will open a consultation on allowing euthanasia for people who can no longer give informed consent or who will die of an illness in the more distant future. Presently, Quebec permits euthanasia for terminally ill adult residents with an incurable disease who are undergoing great suffering, face imminent death, and give informed consent. The Quebec law was passed in 2014 and took effect in December 2015. President Trump says the growth of nuclear weapons production is the biggest problem the world faces today. He made the comments before meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the NATO summit in London. The president says the U.S. and Russia are in discussions to reduce their nuclear creation. And strong upper-level winds are forcing SpaceX to postpone today's launch of a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral. The rocket is poised to deliver a Dragon cargo ship to the International Space Station with 3 tons of fresh supplies. SpaceX will try again Thursday with liftoff scheduled for 12:29 p.m. Eastern Time. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
I'm Al Cresta. Marriage in today's world is something which is, in some ways it's under direct attack. In other ways, it's being undermined by neglect. Those who have had rich, fulfilling marriages do know, however, that identifying and resolving major conflicts in marriage is the key to continue to grow in marriage. My guest, Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons, is a psychiatrist who has counseled and written about excessive anger and other psychological conflicts in marriage, parenting, and actually in priesthood as well. He's been doing this for over 40 years. He's really one of the pioneers in discussing the important role that forgiveness plays in helping people grow, but also sustaining, of course, relationships. And we're blessed to have his book, Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a Handbook for Catholic Couples. Ignatius Press has published it. It's got a foreword by Archbishop Aquila of Denver. And it's a great pleasure to have you with me again, Richard. Thank you.
Oh, great. I'm being here with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's go to the challenges first that marriage seems to be undergoing. I always try to go back to my own experience on this, and I can remember as an adolescent boy thinking that I just want to make it clear, my mother and father remained married until my dad died just 2 years ago. So they had about 67 years of marriage. So I want to make that clear. But when I was an adolescent in the late 1960s, it seemed to me marriage was, It seemed like it was going to be more trouble than it's worth. I was a fairly pagan kid at that time. When I became a Christian in college and began to read the scriptures, I said, whoa, wait a minute here. Marriage is much more than I ever thought it was. It's not just an arrangement between a guy and a girl to live together.
So
that's when I realized that marriage is also something that is intended to help you become more of who God created you to be. It's not just an arrangement between a boy and girl or man and woman to live together and have sexual relations for so many years. Now, in our present, here we are, 2019, marriage is, again, under attack by direct means or passive means by neglect. I would imagine, from what you've seen over 40 years, marriage is in more trouble today than it was when you began your practice.
Look, there's absolutely no question about that, Al. For me, when I began my practice, 1976, finished my training. 2 years later, John Paul II was made the Holy Father.
Right.
The light in my life, I'm enormously grateful to St. John Paul II. This book is dedicated to him. Every chapter begins with an epigram of him. Every chapter contains his wisdom from love and responsibility, theology of the body, the role of the Christian family in the modern world. He brings light. He brings luminous teaching to a time period where marriage has been neglected. I don't want to be too negative, but it's been neglected because the contraceptive mentality affected everyone, every sacrament, the priesthood, afraid to preach the truth about marriage. It's like a perfect storm. Okay, and then John Paul II came with his writings. Now, so to me, the marriage is no question the explosion of, well, I would say this, the explosion of selfishness, and maybe more than that, Al, the explosion of mistrust, not trusting people.
Yeah.
You know, the hookup culture, the cohabitation culture, the contraceptive culture, it's all shifted. Marriage has shifted from being, you know, what it really truly is, which you discovered, you know, being your college years, sacred, lifelong union, mission of sharing love, raising children, help each other get to heaven. And John Paul II's incredible writing, it radiates. The love between a husband and a wife radiates into the culture. The love of the Trinity, the icon, the model for marriage is the Trinity, nothing less than the Trinity.
Right.
I mean, that's an extraordinary mission to have as a young man or a young woman think, this is my mission in life, radiate God to my to each other and to the Trinity. So it's so, but yes, well, we've had enormous problems and we have enormous struggles going on with marriage. I try to get to Mass as often as I can to put marriage upon the sacrament, upon the altar, and to pray the rosary for the sacrament of marriage.
You've done a lot of work in the area of forgiveness over the years. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, your first chapter starts out, forgiveness reduces anger, quoting St. John Paul II there. Forgiveness is above all a personal choice, a decision of the heart to go against the natural instinct to pay back evil with evil. Excuse me. Even in marriage, of course, unfortunately, we get angry with our spouse and we basically want to settle the score in some way. We might do it with outright attacks, or we might do it by being passive aggressive and, and withholding things that they are due. You've written about the benefits of forgiveness. What's it take for somebody to realize the value of those benefits? I mean, when is some...
Well, you know, I think what's really important here on this question, Al, is the last chapter of the book, which fosters on self-knowledge. Because the forgiveness that many people in their marriage, what they need to enter into very, very deeply, is not what they think. Here's why that is. Because there are three things we do with anger. We deny it, we express it, or we can forgive. What do most of us do with anger until our adult life? Well, we can express it. We can deny it. And where do we deny it? We deny it with a parent who's hurt us the most. And where is that relationship most commonly seen? It's most commonly seen in the father relationship. Not always, but that's an epidemic problem today, parental relationships. So you have, people have buried anger with a father or with their mother. The last chapter is meant to uncover that. And part of the forgiveness process is, it should happen before marriage, before priesthood, which parent disappointed you the most? But there was only, we don't want to be critical of parents, they're great gifts to our lives, but the reality is this, there was only one perfect family. All the rest of us have baggage, without exception. Mm-hmm. And so what is it? Honey, what's mine? What's yours? So that chapter is meant to do that. That should be done before marriage. So, okay, your father was cold. Your father was controlling. Your mother decided to divorce because she didn't feel good about it. She was not happy. Okay, it took the totally cultural view of marriage. Marriage is about me,
right.
Not we, not about sacrificing, right? So sometimes forgiving in marriage life, it's important to think about, all right, I'm going to forgive my spouse, I want to be sensitive, I want to grow in virtues, but also thinking about forgiving the parents and even who hurt one the most, and even coaching one's husband or one's wife or children and thinking about forgiving others who they might even be aware of that they need to forgive out.
You know, I think that's a very important point. Do you suggest then that people go back and basically try to think critically?
Right.
I don't mean with a critical spirit, but with a critical intelligence. Go back and evaluate your father, your mother.
So that's what this last chapter of this book is about. So yesterday, a rector of a seminary, I sent it to him, and I asked the rector of this seminary, I'd recommend, Monsignor, that you read the last chapter first. Okay, why? Because that uncovers what should be uncovered in young men training to be priests. It should be uncovered before they even go into the seminary. Okay, what are the strengths of your parents? What are the weaknesses growing in what's called affective maturity in seminary formation? Well, the same thing should happen prior to marriage. There's no reason. It has not happened. We have improved premarital programs. Thank you to the teaching of John Paul II. However, there's a level of growth that needs to happen in the psychological area. That's what this last chapter is meant to focus on. We can learn, okay, strengths in parents, weaknesses, and Lord, help, I want to repeat that my parents' good qualities, but the bottom line is when you uncover the weaknesses, psychotherapy is not going to get you over that.
Hmm.
Virtues, habits, grace will get you over that. Thinking, all right, I'm powerless over the weakness I've got from my father, a lot of men. My father was emotionally distant. I'm emotionally distant as a father, as a husband. I don't try to protect my wife enough from loneliness. Extremely important. We're the protectors. We men have to protect our wives from loneliness and from anxiety. And so then we ask God to help us to repeat our father's good qualities, not his weaknesses. And this, our fathers would want that. I would want that for my three daughters to repeat my good qualities, but not my weaknesses. So this book talks about going deep. It talks about the childhood and the married life, both. So you can't separate the two. Because the psychological science is a young field, but there is research that would indicate maybe 75% of people's adult psychological problems may come from unresolved issues from their background,
right,
with the exception of selfishness, of course. That's not something, but you can model it, but that's something people just give into.
Right.
And unfortunately, lots of people are giving into it, and that's why marriage is in such a terrible shape, because of people just thinking, me.
Yeah.
Not we.
You point something out here, which once a person discovers it, it's part of their working knowledge. But it's this, that we actually begin, as we grow up, we actually do begin to resemble our parents.
Absolutely.
And my wife pointed that out to me a long time ago. And I always thought my dad and I were so different, you know, because our interests were different. But the mannerisms, you know, unconscious responses to situations.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And modeling is the same thing with my father. Modeling is extremely powerful.
Yes.
It is extremely powerful. And so part of the whole goal in Catholic marriage is this. It's to become another Christ to our spouse and to our children. That's very demanding work, but it's inspiring work because we feel much more fulfilled when we're more Christ-like, we're loving, we're patient, you know, all these virtues that now require daily work and confession and the Eucharist, you know, et cetera, to the rosary to grow in.
The positive psychology movement that's come about over the last, I don't know, 20, 25 years, has recovered the concept of virtue.
In
the field of psychology and therapy. So this is a positive thing, right?
This is very incredible. To me, I joke with my colleague at the University of Wisconsin, Bob Enright, who's done all the pioneering work. He has forgiveness education programs in 30 countries in the world, wow. K through 12. And I said, you know, this is the fact that this has happened to me is an indication that there's some contemplative sisters who have really been praying for the mental health field for a long time.
That's good. That's good. Hold it there. We'll be back, Richard. My guest, Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons, Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a Handbook for Catholic Couples. Again, talking about this absolutely vital area of our lives, whether you're married or whether you're a young Catholic person, wondering, what is marriage like? What's the possibility? What's the future for me in this? This is something you want to focus in on.
During the 2 days of the Democrat presidential candidate debates held this past July at the Fox Theater in Detroit, the city and its police force imposed draconian restrictions that prevented anyone with a message that conflicted with the policies of the Democrat candidates, particularly messages that conflicted with the candidates' radical pro-abortion policies, from reaching the debate participants and attendees. As a result, we sued the city and several of its police officers and the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan for silencing the speech of our pro-life clients, Created Equal and its co-founder, Mark Harrington. Indeed, the right to freedom of speech enshrined in the First Amendment is not a right to catharsis. It is a right to meaningfully express one's message in order to influence public opinion and to affect public policy. Not surprisingly, the liberal city of Detroit imposed restrictions that had the intended effect of sanitizing and cleansing the areas immediately in front of and adjacent to the Fox Theater of any messages that were critical of the Democrat presidential candidates and the positions and policies they supported. In particular, these instructions ensured that our clients' message, specifically including their pro-life signs, would be hidden from the CNN camera shots, the viewers of the debates, the candidates, and those who attended the Fox Theater for the debates. Our Constitution does not permit such treatment. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish, and we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we had never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at VisitingAngels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons. He has done a great deal of thought over the years about St. John Paul II's work in theology of the body and love and responsibility. And it has shaped his own work as a psychiatrist and therapist. And he has given us a lot of this insight in the book, Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a handbook for Catholic couples. We were talking last segment about the self-knowledge, the humility that's necessary to understand who we are. I want to come back to the selfishness thing because, you know, from the time we're little kids, we're told don't be selfish. And yet it seems almost natural to be selfish.
Right.
You know, it comes easy.
Very easy. I mean, Pope Benedict wrote that selfishness has an effect on us like the effect of gravity.
Yes.
I mean, I joked with my wife when I married her, honey, you're so fortunate to marry me. I've been working on my baggage for years. And one day she said, what about selfishness, Rick? And I went, oh, my God.
That's great.
You know?
That'll do it. But where do we find this asserting itself in those? How do we sustain it? I mean, we're Catholics, for heaven's sakes, right?
I think we all have to work harder in virtues to become Christ-like, and we have to. My hope is that this book really helps Catholic couples to realize their responsibility not to give in to the culture. Because like you were saying, Al, earlier, the culture says, oh, me, take it easy, comfort-seeking. No, don't correct your son or your daughter because they're acting selfish. We only got two kids. We don't want to upset the kids. No. We've got to correct. We've got to correct ourselves, you know, fight selfishness, fight this terrible tendency, control. See, here's what happens. The more selfish people are, the more controlling they are. And so this is one of the major reasons for the explosion of divorce. These two factors, Al, too selfish and then too controlling. And from too controlling, I want my way all the time. If I don't, boom, the anger goes through the roof. You know, so all these things are weaknesses that we need to recognize are very powerful in this culture. We don't want to give in to them. We don't want to accompany them. No. We want to fight against them. We want to resolve them so we can become more Christ-like.
So selfishness, then, it has an active side to it. I mean, we kind of organize our lives to gratify ourselves, and so when things don't go as expected, then we have excessive anger.
Exactly. And this selfishness has really done enormous damage to young people because it hasn't been corrected. The contraceptive mentality has not been strongly corrected enough. And so we have this massive hookup culture, this massive retreat from marriage. In 1969, we had 430,000 Catholic marriages in the United States. In 2016, we had 144. We're like 420, 144.
Wow.
And so we have this massive retreat from marriage. Part of it is because the total selfishness, hooking up, cohabiting, being totally irresponsible, I mean, not truly loving someone, you know, using someone, constantly being used. And so we have this severe explosion of psychiatric illness. We have this explosion of suicide in this culture.
I know.
Because there's a hopelessness about what's most fundamental to all of us, finding someone we can fully give ourselves to and love and marry.
You write that generosity conquers selfishness. Explain that.
So that's the movement. That's the virtue that helps us grow in self-giving and in thinking many times daily, we, not me. That's the virtue that Thomas Aquinas describes that helps us wish the best for the other. So we wish the best for our husband and wife. Now, the total best for our husband and wife is that they would go into eternal life, right? That's the complete best.
Right.
But then there are other ways. We want to be kind. We want to be a positive communicator. We want to protect them, be generous in praising them and showing them love, and generous also, you know, in correcting. I mean, one of the problems I've seen in my work with couples is too oftentimes there's a problem and it's not corrected. And one of the reasons it's not corrected is the children, too. It's not corrected because, oh, that's too much work. That's too hard. So it's selfishness that even limits good Christian correction. Like, oh, honey, come on, try to give the control to God. Something no more than that. Let's give the control to God. It can help people with this compulsive need to control, which is not a minor problem.
Right.
Marriage today.
You mentioned the rise in suicide. This was a topic we discussed a few days ago on this program.
Ah.
And the numbers, especially for young women, are terrifying.
They are.
And there's also this, often here too, that there's been a boom in loneliness, reported loneliness. loneliness has to play into suicide.
Oh, totally. Completely.
And this is from the absence of hope, I suppose.
God's first words to Adam were, Adam, it's not good for a man to be alone.
Right.
I maintain he could have gone on for 10 more chapters in Genesis.
And that's before the fall, too.
Yeah. Right. All the things that it does.
Yeah.
It does terrible things to people. So when you've been in a hookup culture, when you've been contracepting, and you've not really given yourself, we're not meant to give ourselves to many people. We're meant to marriage and love are fulfilled in one place, and that's in the sacrament. That's in married life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in hookup culture. It's not in cohabitation. That's where authentic human love and sexuality are realized. It's in marriage. And if you've had all this hookup culture, you feel profoundly lonely, and then they feel helpless through many different relationships, and they feel like giving up. I can't. Some days, Al, I feel like an army medic on a battlefield.
Yeah.
All these young people who've been hookup, used. I mean, they're totally depressed. They're extremely anxious. They're mistrustful. They're angry. God, help us.
I'm sure you come across people who say, I've been loose. I've been part of this hookup culture. And I don't feel that I can ever give myself to a spouse the way I ought to.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I'm on the ash heap of romantic history here.
Well, I think that predisposes you. That's what makes holiday weekends for such people extraordinarily painful. Vacation times extraordinarily painful because there's not that one other person to share their life with.
Right.
And so, I mean, I sometimes describe this as, well, this is just like the alcoholic or the drug addict who used to try to get psychotherapy. No one got better. No one really made improvement in treating addictive diseases until the spiritual component was brought in.
Mm-hmm.
Power this over this, turn it over to God. I make that recommendation. Hope is a powerful virtue. So trying to pursue the virtue of hope that's described in this book, the writing about hope in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's profound. You read it, it just lifts you right up when you read it. It's incredible. Anointed. You know, so I think we need to convey to others hope, and we have to discourage people from the contraceptive mentality. But, you know, we have a battle because we have the whole culture, even many of our Catholic universities, you know, supporting it, affirming it. You know, the failure to really preach against it is very troubling. John Paul II certainly preached against it and warned about what's happening now.
We've seen all these things. Interesting. I'm always curious about the connection between these things. So with the rise of the hookup culture, you also have parallel growth in depression.
Absolutely.
What's the connection there? Is there a connection, causal connection?
There is an absolute connection. It's being, for the young women especially, there is an, in the book, we cite one of the stuff from in the depression chapter, two studies out of Denmark, one with 1 million women, one with 500,000 women, and that the depressive illness and those on contraceptives was 2 to 3 times what it was those who were not on contraceptives, and the suicide rate was markedly higher on those young women. We're talking about young women who were using contraceptives, who probably were sexually active from a very early age. God knows how many sexual partners they've had. And when you, as a woman, feel used, women don't want to be used sexually. They want love, yes, of course, but they want friendship. They want a deep, bonded friendship with a male who will love them and protect them and cherish them. Good luck finding that in men who are selfish today.
Yeah. So
I think it's the trauma that particularly women are sustaining. Not that men aren't. They are. Like I think a lot of their treat from marriage is that men, you know, are afraid that they see many women as just giving in to the cultural view of marriage. Well, it's all about material possessions. Well, you don't make enough money.
Yeah.
I can't go out with you. You're not making enough. You won't give me the finer things in life that I want and that I'm used to.
That kind of calculation, you know, evaluating a potential partner by you're going to give me a material way of life that I like, it seems to me that that's sowing the seeds of the destruction very early on, because
there's powerful selfishness
yeah.
in the very, very beginning.
Yeah.
Where the Christian view is, we trust God. I mean, my father had 5 children. Could my father afford 5 children? No.
Right.
But he trusted that God would provide, and God provided all the days of his life.
Yeah. This brings me up to, with gratitude, which you write about here, and how gratitude builds confidence. Many years ago, I noticed in St. Paul's writings that oftentimes he would go down a list of vices or sins. And in contrast to that list, he would say, in contrast, be thankful in all thanksgiving. So there's something about the interior motion of gratitude or thanksgiving, which really does kind of push aside all these vices that are, you know, like dogs nipping at our heels.
Right. Well, that's totally true. I think I've thought about this, and one of the things that may do thanksgiving and gratitude is it puts us more in the position where we may be in our eternal life, you know, in the praise of God.
Yeah, yeah.
Put us more in touch with God, who is Father, and that so many men we work with have such male insecurity, and because of that they're irritable, or they drink too much, or they're hard on their wives, or critical of their children. But as they enter into more gratitude for their God-given gifts, you know, maybe their dad didn't praise them enough or whatever happened, their work is hard, but as they enter into more gratitude for their God-given gifts, their confidence rises significantly, and they think, all right, so I had some bumps in the road growing up, or wasn't a great athlete, or had challenges in my work, but gratitude for one's gifts helps one weather some of these stormy waters in life.
You have a phrase in the book, it's chapter 10 is the title of it, that I've actually never seen anywhere before. Justice prevents divorce.
Oh, yes.
Justice prevents divorce.
Oh.
Now, for a lot of people, they're thinking, wait a minute, how can that be? Demanding my due, that's what got me into marital trouble in the first place. So in what sense does justice prevent divorce?
Justice prevents divorce by that virtue helps us recognize we have to give to God what he is due.
Yeah.
And we have to give to our spouses and our children what they are due. And when the thought of divorce, this is an issue that really touches me deeply, and when that, the thought of divorce is there, they have a grave responsibility to work honestly at facing his or the one who's thinking of divorcing. Look at your weaknesses. They have weaknesses. There's only one perfect family, right?
Right.
What are your weaknesses? And then look at your spouse's weaknesses and work on those weaknesses. Most marital conflicts can be resolved. So you give God what is due. What is due to God? He put the sacramental bond there. You owe him fidelity. And look, work on the bond. And as John Paul II says, be loyal to the core goodness of your spouse. The weaknesses are on the periphery of the goodness. Okay, you work on the weaknesses, stay loyal to the goodness, and marital conflicts can be resolved, and marriages can be healed.
Rick, can you stay with me a little longer?
Of course.
Very good. My guest, Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons, Habits for a Healthy Marriage. I'm Al Kressel. We'll be right back.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria mutual funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for December is the EWTN Family Christmas Special. The Choir of the Eternal Word Television Network performs classical Christmas carols with a special commentary by Father Joseph Mary Wolfe. Order your DVD or CD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
You need courage to stand up and be Christian, and stand up and be a real Catholic, not a divided Catholic.
Mother Angelica courageously evangelized the world. One of the first ways she evangelized was through small books full of powerful messages. You can have all of Mother's beloved mini books in one complete collection in The Spiritual Wisdom of Mother Angelica from EWTN Publishing, now available at EWTNRC.com.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Stress is contagious, even for toddlers. A new study by the University of Cambridge found that even after controlling for temperament, the more stressed moms and dads felt, the more their toddlers tended to be clingy, tantruming, whiny, and defiant. In general, kids are terrific emotional barometers. Little ones especially are always taking their emotional cues from us, even when we think we're keeping it to ourselves. Parents' stress plays out in our facial expressions, our posture, our attitudes, and our ability to pay attention, all things our kids attend to closely. When our kids notice us feeling stressed, it makes them feel unsafe and causes them to act out. If your little one seems off, a good first step is asking yourself how you're managing your own stress level. An ounce of self-care can sometimes be worth a pound of discipline. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons, author of Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a Handbook for Catholic Couples. We've been taking a look at how John Paul II's thought in the theology of the body and his moral teaching and Love and Responsibility, one of his earlier works, really plays into helping Catholics grow in marriage and, again, help equip one's spouse and children to become all that God created them to be. In other words, to become saints, something which I think a lot of American Catholics, anyways, are still uncomfortable talking about. What about that? When I was growing up as a Catholic kid, nobody would have said, in my circle of acquaintances, nobody would have said, I want to be a saint. It would have been considered incredibly presumptuous.
Right.
You know, the best we could hope for was purgatory. I mean, and again, I want to stress, I was not well catechized as a kid. So, but that was kind of the popular ethos where I grew up in Connecticut. Anybody mm-hmm. who wanted to become a saint was considered very arrogant. How do husband and wife get comfortable really saying that? I'm here to help you become a saint.
That's a great question, Al. I think it's an area that is really discussed, but I think it's a very important issue you're raising, and I think it should be discussed.
Yeah.
You know, what's the marriage about? Well, you have all these pressures and responsibilities, thank God, taking care of children and the home and whatnot, education and doing what's best for your children. But I think there also needs to be time for the marriage and talking about, you know, John Paul II would talk about the marital romantic love, and Love and Responsibility, the importance of romantic love, the importance of the marital friendship, and betrothed love, which includes intimacy, but it's the total surrender of yourself to your spouse. Responsibility, the importance of romantic love, the importance of the marital friendship, and betrothed love, which includes intimacy, but it's the total surrender of yourself to your spouse. So I think having time to talk about that, reminding one, you know, it's like a tune-up, right? A marital tune-up. Honey, you know, we're about the number one goal here is to be loving to each other, yes, of course, but to help each of us get to heaven and to help our children get to heaven. So I think there's, yeah, but I think you're right. I think in the culture there's been a sort of a loss of that vocation to holiness, that there's a sacred vocation to go to. I'm older than you, Alan. When I was in high school, big Catholic boys' high school, I think maybe 18 guys in my high school class went off to priesthood or religious life.
Mm.
And that was viewed, we admired those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
We looked up to them. We admired. It was manly.
Yeah.
It was like going into, you know, it's like being a Marine in a way.
Right.
They were going
right.
off to be spiritual Marines. and we greatly admire that. But then we've had this unfortunate, you know, things that have happened in the priesthood and weaknesses in male confidence that have resulted in some major problems. But we trust that there'll be a renewal of that in time.
Do you know, I mean, I'm sure you've given a lot of thought to this. What happened to that ideal of the, you know, the priest who was strapping, you know, solid, you know, a man's man kind of thing?
And I don't mean
to be unkind here, but that's, at least in America, it seems like the Catholic priesthood has shied away from that. Away from that, and John Paul II is actually quite contrary to this.
Oh, is he ever?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting you asked that question. When in high school, I had Augustinian priests teach me, and in college, extremely manly Jesuit priests teach me. I greatly admired them, both places. But I think what happened, and I could be wrong about this, and I've written about this, related to the crisis in the Church. I think when the rebellion against Humanae Vitae came, and it came powerfully, it came like a cardinal, the former Cardinal Denner, Stafford, wrote about this. It was almost like a firestorm. It was unbelievable what happened. And I think what happened then was priests began to be afraid to preach the truth about sexual morality and didn't preach it. And so when a priest does not preach the truth about sexual morality, psychologically what happens is he's not configured to Jesus Christ as he should be, and that he's vulnerable to make mistakes, and he's weakened.
Yeah.
He's profoundly weakened, okay?
Yep.
And when you're weakened, you're not as manly as you should be.
Yep.
I think we've had terrible crisis of weakness in men and the sacrament of marriage and in the sacrament of holy orders, and they need to be strengthened. My hope book is, grandiose, but I'm hopeful that this book will help strengthen husbands and will help strengthen priests to be, you know, to fulfill their vocation and to communicate the truth and not be afraid what anyone thinks.
Amen. Rick, thanks so much. Great talking with you again.
Great having you.
And, we'll talk soon. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons will have the book available online. Habits for a Healthy Marriage, a Handbook for Catholic Couples. And I'd like to pick up on something that Rick pointed out. Look, the ideal of marriage has been under attack. 40% of births are occurring outside marriage. And divorce is no longer escalating like it did during the 1970s and 80s and into the 90s. But we still have a generation of men and women who are adult children of divorce. And now, with the claim that there are over 100 genders, right? Young people and adolescents are growing up in a world where there's tremendous confusion and uncertainty about life. I mean, even the most basic distinctions you learn to make when you're an infant between male and female and mommy and daddy, even that's being called into question because 40% are growing up without a daddy. It's a tough time. And again, the good news for us is that Christ has given us a mission. And that is a mission to demonstrate that he is who he said he was, and that what he's revealed to us about the nature of life, the nature of us, the nature of God, is true and leads to fulfillment. Now, Rick raised a question in our conversations about husbands taking responsibility to protect their wives from loneliness. Now, I don't think I'd actually heard that brought up before. Of course, I've heard preached the ideal that a husband must love his wife as Christ loved the church, but I don't think I've ever heard any speaker, including myself, ever focus on this husband's responsibility to protect one's wife from loneliness. And this is wickedly ironic, isn't it? God said it's not good for Adam to be alone. And let me stress, he said that before the fall. He said this before sin and alienation came into the world. Even in God's good creation, it was not good for man to be alone. And in so many marriages, of course, husbands and wives don't grow closer together, but they drift farther apart. And in fact, in his book, Rick tells a story of Sandra and Ken. Sandra, and he describes her entering his office. She's smiling, but she's got puffy red eyes. And, you know, he asks her reason for coming. And she says, well, I don't know what's wrong. I really love my husband, Ken, but there's something missing in our relationship. And she explained that for the first years of their marriage, Ken was great, loving, attentive. After their first child was born, he was a great dad. Next child came along. Ken still did fine, but he began to spend less time at the house, more time doing activities that he enjoyed, jogging and fishing and golfing, sitting in front of big screen TV, not communicating as much as he used to. And Sandra said, look, I try to tell him that I need his help with the kids and to protect me from feeling lonely. And I can't do this by myself. And every time I try to talk to him, he just tells me I'm being selfish. He says, look, I work hard. I'm supporting us. And he does, by the way. He supports us fine. But is it selfish for me to want him to spend time with us instead of spending so much time at work or watching sports and playing golf on weekends with his buddies? She became quite emotional about it. Sometimes, she said, I feel like I'm less important to him than his big screen TV and the internet. Well, Ken came into the next session, and good news is that Ken actually is a man of strong Catholic faith and in personal integrity. And he said he didn't realize that he had been coming across this way, that he had, in fact, given in to this kind of lure of selfishness. He had disguised his selfishness as his need for relaxation to compensate for the demands of his job. I understand that. He felt that his hard work had earned him the leisure he was enjoying. But the fact was that selfishness had changed him. He began thinking more about himself and less about Sandra and the children. And his desires were getting placed in front of theirs. Now, the good news again is that Ken and Sandra began to work on this. But this came back to a slow and painful recognition that they had given in to selfishness. Rick said, quoting Benedict XVI, that selfishness is a lot like gravity. It's kind of the natural default for us when we forget our relationships with others and our responsibilities in those relationships. And when we give in, we become increasingly self-centered. And you know you're self-centered when, in fact, little challenges to the way your day was supposed to go or your night was supposed to go leads to outbursts of anger. This is something which I think humans naturally fall into. We don't want to be frustrated. We want to do something. And if someone keeps us from doing it, we get frustrated. And one of the most well-documented things we know from study of psychology is that frustration leads to aggression. And that means then treating those around us either more commonly with anger or more likely in a Christian home, withdrawing into oneself. Because, of course, being angry with your wife and kids is not really socially acceptable within the Christian community. So we stuff it. We push it down. And then to compensate for it, we remind ourselves of how hard we work. We have an exaggerated sense of our self-importance. And, of course, the more self-important we are, the less attentive we are to the people around us, which means then we don't do the normal etiquettes, the normal courtesies, the normal questions. How's your day? How'd you do on that test? We have immature and comfort-seeking behaviors that we engage in. I'm talking about largely men here, guys. Since I never will know what it's like to be a woman, I can only speak from being a man. And then I think for a lot of guys, there's an ambition for success, which is very hard to distinguish from the responsibility to provide. And I know this is from conversation with people over the years, close friends. I've been blessed with good Christian friends all my adult life. I think this is one of the hardest things for the men that I know. Now, women can have this too, but I'm talking, again, about the men that I know. To distinguish between kind of a blind ambition for success, to make it, and how to distinguish that from the daily responsibility of doing your job well so that you can provide properly for your family. Where's that line between, you know, blind ambition and provision? Doing the necessary thing for provision. Very important to keep this clear in our minds. Rick Fitzgibbons does a great job of it in Habits for a Healthy Marriage. We'll have it available for you in the online bookstore. I'm Al Cresta. Stay with me. More coming up.
Believers who respond to God's word and become members of Christ's body are intimately united to him, the Catholic Catechism tells us. In that body, those who believe are united with Christ through the sacraments in a very real and hidden way. The body's unity does not do away with the diversity of its members who engage in a diversity of functions. The unity of the mystical body triumphs over all human divisions. As St. Paul says, there are no Jews, no Greeks, no slave, no free man. All are one in the body of Christ. Christ is the head of the body of the church, the principle of creation and redemption. We are united with Christ in his Passover. All his members must strive to resemble him until Christ is formed in them. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms. Stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
And thanks so much for joining us over the last 2 hours of Crest in the Afternoon. You, of course, can follow up on all of today's discussions with Dr. Fitzgibbons, Troy Guy, and Dr. Greg Popchuk in the Crest Guest Archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Coming up next on Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, we'll have Catholic Answers Live. Archbishop Alexander Sample of Portland, Oregon, takes your calls on the mission of the Church. And then Jimmy Akin will be taking a look at Old Testament prophecies. After that, on EWTN Live, Father Willie Raymond, CSC, will be looking at the work of Father Patrick Payton. Be sure to tune in and catch all of that. Coming up tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon, our good friends Bruce and Chris McGregor will be guest hosting the program. They'll be talking with Matthew Bunsen, Peter Dresser-Smith, and many, many more, looking at stories in the church as well as other stories like euthanasia in Canada, which is continuing to progress at a very alarming rate. Tune in tomorrow. We'll talk to you then. Have a great evening and God bless.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.